You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org, Medscape Cardiology. This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Any views expressed are the presenter's own and do not necessarily reflect the views of WebMD or Medscape.
You can now access the latest in medical news on your Amazon Alexa-enabled device. Join me, Perry Wilson, every weekday morning for Medscape Medical Minute, where I highlight the top medical stories of the day. To add Medscape Medical Minute to your flash briefing, search for Medscape Medical Minute on Amazon and click Enable. Or open the Amazon Alexa app, go to Skills, search for Medscape Medical Minute, and click Enable. Then say, Alexa, what's the news? Or Alexa, what's my flash briefing? I hope you'll join us.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology. And this is This Week in Cardiology for January 5th, 2024. This week, neuromodulation in heart failure, private equity ownership of hospitals, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, sudden cardiac death prevention in the ICD are reevaluated, and peer review. First of all, I want to say Happy New Year, and I hope everybody had a good holidays. Let's start off with barostimulation for heart failure. While we were opening presents, drinking eggnog, and racing cyborgs on Zwift, our FDA, and here in the U.S., expanded the indication for barostimulation in patients with heart failure. About a year ago, a vascular surgeon friend asked me what I thought of this carotid stimulation device. And I scratched my head, and I'm like, why are you asking, and what are you talking about? Apparently, our hospital system was considering at that time doing barostimulation and it required a vascular surgeon. He told me he had looked at the study and it didn't seem that impressive to him, but he's not really a study critical appraiser. And at that time, I remember briefly looking back at the BEAT-HF study, and I didn't think there was much there, but I paid it little attention, mainly because this therapy didn't have much traction and I hadn't seen anybody with a device. Well, over the holidays, the FDA approved an expanded label for the Barostim neuromodulation system in patients with heart failure, and it incorporated longer-term post-marketing clinical data from the BEAT-HF randomized clinical trial. Now, the manufacturer of this device, called CVRx, had announced that the updated labeling for Barostim now states that the device is indicated for patients with NYHA class 3 or class 2 who have a recent history of class 3 disease despite treatment with GDMT and also have an LVEF less than 35% and an N-terminal proBNP level less than 1600 picograms per milliliter. I smile at this because I did not really know there was any indication, and now there's an expansion of an indication. So let's do some brief background. I went back and looked at that, and then let's do the regulatory trial, which says some very serious limitations. The grand idea here is that there are a group of patients with HFrEF who still have symptoms and a bad ejection fraction despite medical therapy, and sadly, their QRS duration precludes benefit from CRT. I get shown EKGs all the time of these patients, and I look at it and I'm like, sorry, that QRS is not going to get better with CRT. This is the patient who might improve with modulation of the autonomic nervous system. And a company called CVRx came up with a subcutaneously implanted device placed in the left upper chest, like a pacemaker. A lead is tunneled from that device to the carotid bulb area, which delivers stimulation to the carotid area with the goal of decreasing sympathetic tone, you know, like beta blockade. Basically, it counters the excessive sympathetic tone in heart failure. And there was a regulatory trial, and it was called BEAT-HF. The company and academics worked with FDA to design this trial. It's an adaptive trial. It's a complicated trial. The main publication that I could find, at least, is in JACC 2020, first author Dr. Michael Zeil. And BEAT-HF had four cohorts. Each was a randomized trial. Some of these were designed for pre-market approval. The main publication focuses on the last cohort of 260 patients randomized one-to-one to barostimulation plus medical therapy versus medical therapy alone. This is so-called cohort D, and it's the intended use indication. Now, the primary endpoint of this cohort D BEAT-HF study was a composite of three things: quality of life scores, 6-minute walk times, and NT-proBNP. And at follow-up 6 months, the BAT group had better quality of life, longer 6-minute walk test, and slightly better NT-proBNP levels, and all of these differences that favored BAT were statistically significant. But of course, I hope regular listeners already can see the limitations. A, this is a surgical procedure that requires indwelling hardware and a vascular surgeon, so it's not nothing. B, there were no clinical outcomes in any of this, such as heart failure hospitalizations or CV death. And C, this is the hugest issue, I think. There was no placebo or sham procedure. Patients in the device arm knew they had had surgery, a device, and patients in the medical arm knew they did not. Gosh, I just don't know. What are people thinking? Of course there'll be a placebo effect. The authors tell us that the lack of placebo is why they use the NT-proBNP, which is an objective measure. It's a blood test. But come on, blood pressure is also an objective measure, and look what happened with the early renal denervation trials. Because patients who have surgery may have done other things that help lower their BNP, like a better diet, less salt, more exercise, better adherence to medicines, etc. I really had no idea how weak the evidentiary data for barostimulation was. And then reading that the FDA expanded the indication last month, well, this stimulated me to look harder at this data. And then I found more data. What I found was that Dr. Zeil actually presented longer-term data from the BeAT-HF looking at clinical outcomes in March of 2023. And he did this at the THT meeting. THT is Technology and Heart Failure Therapeutics Conference, and there was basically no improvement in the composite of CV death and heart failure events. Well, at my place, we refer most of our advanced heart failure patients out to transplant centers. We don't use this device. I've never seen a patient with one, but it is FDA approved, but it's FDA approved with uncontrolled data and no clinical outcome benefits. It's so weird. I just wonder, how could this be? And of course, you know that I'm not against innovation, but why would we not require a proper placebo-controlled trial, or perhaps one powered for clinical endpoints? If you're a heart failure person and you know of stronger data, please alert me and I will update this critical appraisal in the next podcast. But gosh, I just don't know what people are thinking. All right, second topic is about hospital adverse events rise after private equity acquisition. Now, this podcast has been interested in critical appraisal of medical evidence, and over the holidays, there were a number of interesting studies that were, okay, loosely associated with cardiology, but I particularly like dissecting observational studies that pretend to draw causal inferences. There's good lessons here. And JAMA itself published a study looking at changes in hospital adverse events and patient outcomes that were associated with private equity acquisition. Now, I'm not sure what's happening outside of the U.S., but here, many hospitals are being acquired by private equity groups. In the paper, the authors tell us that private equity has an often distinct business model in which the acquired entity typically assumes debt in the initial acquisition and is sold within a short time frame, usually around 3 to 7 years. When I asked GPT what do private equity firms seek to gain when acquiring hospitals, it said that there can be many goals, but listed the first as profitability and financial returns. Then, you know, I get the sense that profit in the healthcare sector is kind of a baddie. Indeed, the Biden administration is scrutinizing these takeovers. So the Bayesian priors before an observational study looking at outcomes after takeovers may be that health scientists expect to find worse outcomes because profit in healthcare is bad. So here's a brief summary of the study that was published in JAMA. Harvard authors used Medicare claims data, now Medicare means adults greater than 65, to study outcomes at 52 private equity acquired hospitals versus 259 matched control hospitals, and they looked at outcomes over a decade, and there were a bunch of hospitalizations, like more than 4 million in this big data study. So essentially, this was a non-random comparison study looking back at claims data. The main outcome measures were bad things that happened in the hospital, falls, infections, but they also looked at mortality at discharge disposition and readmissions. Now, more than 100 news organizations covered the results, and more than 1,000 people tweeted it. And you can guess the results. Profit motive in hospital care is bad. The authors found a roughly 25% increase in hospital-acquired conditions at acquired hospitals versus controls. This was driven by a 27% increase in falls, 37% increase in central line infections, and a doubling of surgical site infections. And the news coverage was all bad, right? Headlines all related bad outcomes after profiteers take over. Well, I am no fan of excessive profiteering in the care of people who are asking for our help, but I also think the use of dubious evidence to advance a good idea is also a really bad thing. So let's look at this study. First, the relative increase of 25% of adverse events sounds terrible, right? But the absolute increase in, say, falls was equal to an extra 2 falls per 10,000 admissions. In fact, all of the adverse outcomes were measured in per 10,000 admissions. So think about it, an extra 2 falls per 10,000 admissions. I'm sorry, this may be statistically significant, but I'm thinking the other 9,998 patient admissions had no falls and no difference. So lesson number one, I think, from this study is studies with millions of patients and millions of encounters can have tiny differences that still reach statistical significance. The second issue, if private equity was so bad, right, if it led to more hospital bad outcomes, then why didn't it also associate with an increase in mortality? In fact, mortality was less in the private equity group. And guess what? This lower mortality also met statistical significance. Now, the authors downplay this finding by saying it is explained by a healthier case mix and that also there was no difference in mortality at 30 days. Except when they adjusted for observable variables, the mortality remained lower at those really bad private equity-owned hospitals. And the third issue, of course, is the authors tell us in the limitations sections, quote, private equity acquisitions are not random, and private equity firms may acquire hospitals for unobserved reasons, so our findings remain susceptible to unmeasured confounding and do not imply causation. Okay, of course. So my take home and the lessons from this JAMA paper, always be wary of news headlines from observational studies. This one is from a smart group at Harvard, and it looked to be a very detailed and careful analysis. But big data like this is noisy, right? There are tiny absolute differences. And if these hospital outcomes were so bad, why didn't it lead to higher mortality? I mean, private equity proponents might have spun this study as, hey, we saved lives. They might have easily explained away the higher rates of adverse events as noise or confounding or whatever. I highlight this paper because these types of studies are common in our field of cardiology, but I just don't think they're capable of giving big policy answers because of the difficulty in noise and confounding. Look at the paper and tell me why I am wrong. All right, third topic is in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and a new drug may be coming soon. Also over the holiday, we got positive news regarding a new novel drug for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Cytokinetics, the makers of the myosin inhibitor aficamten, AFICAMTEN, announced top-line results of a trial called SEQUOIA-HCM, a phase 3 placebo-controlled trial in patients with HCM. Now, this is from the press release. The company writes that aficamten significantly improved exercise capacity compared to placebo. The treatment effect with aficamten was consistent across all pre-specified subgroups of patient baseline characteristics. Statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvements were also observed in 10 pre-specified secondary endpoints, including the KCCQ, the proportion of patients with greater than one class improvement in NYHA functional class, the change in provoked LV outflow tract gradient, and proportion of less than 30 millimeter gradient at weeks 12 and 24. Left ventricular ejection fraction was observed to be less than 50% in 5 patients in the aficamten group compared to 1 on placebo. So my comments, the market thinks this is going to be a big deal, right? The stock price of Cytokinetics doubled right after the announcement around Christmas. and this data seems positive. The results will be announced at a meeting and published as well, coming in 2024. Now, I don't know about your practice, but the use of the first-generation myosin inhibitor mavacamten has been logistically challenging. Perhaps aficamten will be easier. I mean, the chance of lowering EF with these drugs is certainly a headwind, but a disease-modifying drug for patients with HCM surely seems like a welcome innovation. Let's wait and say more when we see the actual results of this drug. All right, next topic is super exciting. The primary prevention ICD is getting another look. News came this month that the first patient has been randomized in a trial called PROFID-ERA, PROFID, P-R-O-F-I-D. Now, that sentence is pretty bland, right? It almost puts you asleep. But wake up, because this may be the boldest trial done in cardiology in decades. German professors Gerhard Hendricks and Nicholas Dagras will lead this modern-day repeat of the MADIT2 trial. PROFID-ERA challenges the current guidelines that patients with ischemic post-MI cardiomyopathy, ejection fraction less than 35% on GDMT, should have a primary prevention ICD, right? That's what we do. If we have a post-MI patient who's on drugs and they still have an EF of 29 or 30%, we recommend an ICD. It's a class 1 guideline recommendation. But the PROFID will randomize more than 3,000 patients exactly like this, who are post-MI, EF less than 35, to an ICD or no ICD, just guideline-directed medical therapy, and then they're going to measure death, mortality. This will be a non-inferiority design, and I think that's fine, because not having a surgery, implanted hardware, potential for bacteremia, sepsis, or wide-awake shocks is clearly a less invasive treatment option. Now, PROFIT is a many-year trial, so I hope I'm still working or even alive when the results come out, because this is really exciting to me. I can't say enough for the scientific thinking of Hendricks and Dagras here. This trial likely could not have happened in the U.S. I'm not sure we have the equipoise here to even do this trial. But the primary prevention ICD story is a classic one for evidence having expiration dates, right? Think about it. MADIT2 recruited patients around the turn of the century. Heart failure therapy has advanced so much since then. The Kaplan-Meier curves in MADIT2 started to separate after about 1.5 to 2 years, and this was because the proportion of heart failure patients then who died suddenly was substantial. But, we know from the heart failure trial list, in fact, that the proportion of patients with heart failure who have sudden cardiac death has gradually decreased over the years. I want you to read a paper in New England Journal of Medicine. First author is Shen, published in 2017. The authors of this paper, all heart failure trialists, analyzed data from 40,000 patients who were in heart failure ICD trials that went from 1995 to 2014. And they observed a 44% decline in the rate of sudden death across the trials, and this was statistically significant. Get this, the cumulative incidence of sudden death at 90 days after randomization was 2.4% in the earliest trial, and that was decreased to 1% in the most recent trial. Of course, my friends, the only way an ICD can help heart failure patients live longer is if the proportion of sudden cardiac death due to ventricular arrhythmia is high enough. And heart failure in 2023 is a lot different from heart failure in 1999. Now, the other piece of evidence that primary prevention ICDs have lost their net benefit, or at least reduced their net benefit, is Danish, right? Danish trial published in 2016 in patients with only non-ischemic cardiomyopathy but still heart failure. The ICD showed no signal of benefit over background medical therapy. Danish has largely been ignored because it doesn't comport well with the other incentives to use ICDs, and I'll let you figure out what those other incentives are. Now, we shall see what PROFID shows. I strongly suspect it will be quite similar to Danish, but of course, I don't know, so we wait. But what's really invigorating is that the European leaders had the gumption to do this trial. To accomplish such a feat, they had to A, be neutral arbiters of the evidence, B, have the persuasion abilities to convince their European colleagues to actually randomize patients, and C, have the energy to garner funding for it. I've never been more sure that most medical evidence should be reevaluated. It won't be long, for instance, before we see our beloved beta blockers in a different light after MI. Ongoing post-MI beta blocker trials will likely reverse evidence obtained in the 1980s. By the way, speaking of dated evidence, someday I will tell you about how CABG was established back in the 1980s. Final topic is peer review. JAMA Network Open has published a really fun paper led by a group at Stanford that looked at peer review. The study set out to answer questions about the quality of peer review, which is super important, obviously. Much has been written about the vital nature of peer review, but also its severe limitations. Now, severe limitations include being too lax and missing things that should have been found, but also being too restrictive and insular and not allowing findings that question the prevailing dogma. One great example of being too restrictive is my friend Vinay Prasad's medical reversal paper, which was first published in Mayo Clinic Proceedings. This is one of the most important papers of our generation, one of Vinay's most cited. And he told me it was rejected by peer reviewers and editors at least 10 journals. Now, the first author of the current JAMA Network Open paper, Pascal Geldsetzler and his colleagues, did a cross-sectional study of almost 12,000 peer reviews from three general medicine journals. This corresponded to about 4,000 publications. Seemed like a lot of work. These journals included BMC Medicine, the BMJ, and PLOS Medicine. Now, they made an interesting choice for measuring quality in peer review. Their surrogate measure was extremely short peer reviews and how often they inform editorial decisions. Their idea was that a peer review of less than 200 words is poor. Now, I'll come back to that. They found that the median word count of a peer review was 425 words. The overall prevalence of very short, less than 200-word peer reviews was 17% across the three journals. 21% were based on review stats containing 50% or more very short reviews. The authors concluded, quote, in this study of three leading general medical journals, one-fifth of editorial decisions for published articles were likely based at least partially on reviews of such short length that they were unlikely to be of high quality. My take. I like the idea of more systematic empirical study of peer review, and I've been on both sides of peer review, doing it and having papers shaped by insular peer reviewers. This paper is interesting because of its choice of surrogate endpoint, which is very short reviews. They say it occurs one-fifth of the time, and that is bad because short reviews are bad. I'm not so sure about that. Many, many times I read a paper and I want to simply write to the editors, it's fine. That's like three words. The authors describe their study. It's limited in scope. They say so, and they make cautious conclusions, and I don't feel like adding minutia to it is helpful. I'm like, let the readers decide. Readers aren't stupid. Most of the time, my main contribution to peer review is to stop the authors from making outsized conclusions. As a person who thinks that short writing is quite worthy, I don't agree that short reviews are necessarily bad. By the way, short writing is way harder than long writing. You should try it. I see the problem with most medical studies is not their limited methodology, like having small numbers or non-random comparisons, but the problem is the outsized conclusions, and it doesn't take many words in a review to change those things. In most cases, I think medical writing would be improved with fewer, not greater words. When in doubt, of course, cut words. Now, one final comment. This study was made possible because those three journals that they use published the peer reviews. This, I believe, would be a great advancement in cardiology. Think about it. If peer reviews, what you write, was published, reviewer comments would be far better. Now, even if you kept the reviews anonymous, it would still be beneficial to readers to see what the referee wrote and thought. When I do peer review, I write as if it was public and it's going to be seen by everybody. All right, everyone, that is the first This Week in Cardiology of 2024. I am really grateful that you listened. Thank you. And remember, if you like this podcast, please take the time to give us a rating, write us a little review. If you disagree with something, go to the heart.org Medscape Cardiology website, write me a comment. I really appreciate those. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org, Medscape Cardiology. This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Any views expressed are the presenter's own and do not necessarily reflect the views of WebMD or Medscape.